I'm Doug Keel. Thanks for joining us. We're Speaking of Schools, the podcast from South Carolina's Department of Education. A pleasure to have you with us for this week's podcast. And today, we're going to be thinking forward. Actually, Think Forward was the topic of the 2016 Transform SC Spring Conference, which was held in Columbia. Attendees then were inspired to think past conventional reforms and reach for transformational change in the public school system. To do that, they featured Brandon Busteed, Executive Director of Gallup Education, as the keynote speaker, and he approached several key topics in transforming education. So that's our topic today on Speaking of Schools. Dr. Busteed is introduced by Anne-Marie Steritz, President and CEO of the South Carolina Council on Competitiveness. So we're thinking forward today as we're speaking of schools.
Good morning. So pleased to see you today, and thank you so much. It is my privilege to have the opportunity to work with Mike Brennan, with Pamela Lackey, with so much of the leadership in the state, and with all of you. I'm so happy to see such a full room again. Thank you. This has been such an ongoing effort. And on behalf of the South Carolina Council on Competitiveness, we are so thrilled to house Transform SC. We think this is a signature initiative for the state. And it's one of three education and workforce initiatives that is housed and sits under the South Carolina Council on Competitiveness. And we're very proud to be a part of it. Since the council was founded in 2004, education and workforce has always been one of the pillars around which we've built our work. And that's because, as Mike said, we feel it's a competitiveness issue. And as we look at economic development, as we look at other issues in our state, our workforce, our children, our education system is going to underpin everything that we do. So we have always made it a pillar of our work since the beginning. And we believe to secure our long-term economic future for the state, we have to transform our public education system. We have to foster connections between business and industry and really streamline our workforce development system. And if you look at our boilerplate, our mission statement, the other key component to the way that we go about our work at the Council on Competitiveness is that all of this is done in partnership. We carry out everything that we do in partnerships because we believe that's the only way we're going to sustain long-term economic prosperity for our state, is that collaboration. And our speaker this morning, actually, I think will play very much on that theme. We're so pleased to have him here because he believes that as a nation, there is nothing more important that we can do than build the world's most effective educonomy. I love that that term. Thank you so much. By seamlessly integrating our educational system, our employers, and our job creators. Brandon Busteed is the Executive Director of Education and Workforce of Gallup, and he's going to speak to us this morning about his mission to create a national movement that measures educational outcomes that matter most, that connects education to jobs and job creation, and promotes a paradigm shift from knowledge mastery to emotional engagement in education. And he's also going to share with us this morning some groundbreaking research regarding corporate perspectives on higher education. So all of this so very much relevant to us this morning, and I think is really going to set the appropriate tone. Brandon, Mr. Busteed, has done some groundbreaking studies that include the state of America's school, the path to winning again in education, as well as Great Jobs, Great Lives, the Gallup-Purdue Index, and that's a comprehensive study of U.S. college graduates that focuses on their long-term outcomes in work and in life. He has founded two companies and a nonprofit organization, including Outside the Classroom, which is a company that pioneered adaptive online education in alcohol abuse prevention. His work is featured in numerous national publications, all of which would be very familiar to you, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, USA Today, Fast Company. He's been featured on NPR, NBC News Today Show, and that list goes on and on. He has a bachelor's degree in public policy from Duke University and an honorary doctorate from Augustana College. He's a trustee emeritus of Duke and has served on the board of visitors of the Sanford School of Public Policy. He is also a former two-sport NCAA Division I athlete at Duke, and he continues to hone his competitive drive as an avid CrossFitter. And Brandon lives now in Vienna, Virginia, with his wife, Deanna, and two children, Annabelle and Harrison, and we are just so thrilled to have him here in South Carolina with us this morning to celebrate with us and to enlighten with us and help us set the tone for today. So, Brandon, I welcome you. Please come on up.
Well, first of all, it's an absolute delight to be here. I couldn't agree with Mike more about this being the most important meeting happening in South Carolina, and I'll tell you why I think it is from my viewpoint. Because in this room is a gathering that rarely happens in our country today, and that is a conference that brings together policymakers, nonprofit sector participants, employers, and the education sector in the same room. Just pause on that point for a bit and realize how rare that alone is, right? I'm going to talk about huge disconnects between our education system writ large and our employers writ large. I'm going to show you all kinds of evidence that there's very little real collaboration going on across this thing that we could potentially turn into the world's greatest human development pipeline. But on a simple level, we're not even communicating with one another because we rarely have forums like this. I go to a lot of conferences that are focused on higher education, and in that, it's a conference just for provosts. There's another conference for chief business officers. There's another, you get the idea, K-12 conferences. There's one for this, there's one for that. Rarely do we have opportunities to bring all of the key stakeholders together. So first of all, kudos to South Carolina for doing that, and it's a pleasure to be here. So the title of my talk is about this idea of building an edu-economy. And the vision is a relatively simple vision, and that is that this would be a seamless pipeline from birth until death that involves a process of lifelong learning and contribution to society, which for most of us is through a thing we call job or work. But obviously we know there's all kinds of important roles that people play that are not necessarily in full-time employed jobs the way we think about the classic definition. But the idea here is that if we did that right, there would be seamless linkages between early childhood learning programs, our K-12 system, our higher education system, and employers of all shapes and sizes. Now, a lot of times when we have this conversation, when we think about education to work, we're thinking in very narrow terms about for-profit businesses and high-paying jobs. I'm talking about the whole thing. And, of course, the irony is that we have nothing that resembles this vision right now because we barely follow a student from elementary school to middle school in the same school district. I mean, think about this. In the same school district, a student moves from an elementary school to a middle school or a middle school to a high school. And it's almost like an entire reset on what we know about that student, the relationships that that student build or didn't build, right? I mean, we barely help usher them in an effective way from one school to another in the same school district, let alone thinking about the transition from, say, college or university into a workplace. So that's the vision. And before I start diving into a lot of this stuff, I always love to start with kind of a grounding question. And this is one that I hope grounds us all in our thinking about this. So this is actually my favorite Gallup poll question that we've ever asked. This was a question from our daily poll, and we rarely ask open-ended questions. Usually we ask a question and there's a series of responses that you know, can choose. This was an open-ended one, so I'm going to ask all of you to participate if you don't mind. So here was the question. We actually started with a prompt. We said, think about the best teacher that you've ever had. And then we said, put that person's name in your head. So I'd like everybody to do that right now. Think of the best teacher you've ever had. Put that person's name in your head. Now, the first interesting observation is that none of you took more than a split second to come up with that name, did you? It's just instant. And the only trouble you might have had is that you might have had three or four names come to mind, but you had no trouble whatsoever instantly coming up with a name for your best teacher. So then here's the open-ended question we asked. We said, what was it about him or her that made them your best teacher? and we just listened to what Americans said. Do you want to know what the number one word was that Americans used to describe their best teacher? Number one, the most often used word when we listen to what they said in an open-ended response. I'm not a psychic, but I can predict what many of you are thinking when you think about those words. Any ideas what that word is? The number one word Americans use. Have you seen this data before, or are you just... About 30 of you yelled out care. And that's the answer. Now, on one hand, you go, oh, Brandon, that's just a simple old Gallup poll. What's the big deal? On the other hand, you go, no, listen. This is the voice of Americans talking about their best teacher and the thing they cite as being the nexus of why that happened, right, is this word care. So I'm just going to ask you all a simple question to start off right now. How are we measuring care in schools? See, we want to be competitive, and we want to compete, and we want to win, but now the question becomes, what do we want to compete and win on? And I worry right now that our education system, the way we have set it up by the metrics we use to measure the performance of students and teachers in schools, is based on a very, very narrow set of metrics. And I'm not going to suggest that we throw these out, not at all. But what I'm saying is that the ones we're using right now, although necessary, are horribly insufficient. And this is where I will start my case. The first question is, what is our definition of success? This is so important. It's so important through the lens of an individual student, for his or her parents or guardians, right? For teachers to think about this, for all of us to think carefully about what do we mean by success? Because, see, right now, if you weren't careful, you'd think about the definition of success for a student is going to college. See, every school district says their goal is to make students college and career ready. But what they really mean is college ready, because career ready is not something that we hold up as a really high goal to attain for a lot of people right out of high school. By the way, college is not for everybody. I believe in the power of higher education. I believe in the power of lifelong learning. There are so many different ways to achieve lifelong learning that don't necessarily go through the traditional path of an 18 to 22-year-old showing up on a 4-year residential private liberal arts campus, which is the vision that we have in our head for most of us in college today. Here's a newsflash. 75% of all college students enrolled in higher education today in the United States are non-traditional age students. They are, in essence, working adults. So when we think about this 18 to 22-year-old, true, they are part of the population of higher education, but they are a quarter of the students enrolled in higher education. So don't think students equals kids. Students equals a lot of different demographics the way we think about it. Our definition of success right now is the prestige of the college you go to, not just going to college, right? But does it have a brand name? And then on top of that, it's how much money do you make when you get out of college? And maybe the prestige of the company that you go work for. Now, believe me, prestige in those ways has some value in our country. I'm not saying it doesn't have any value, but it's more proxy value than it is qualitative value, and I'll explain more about what I mean. But if our only measure of success is the grades that students get, the test scores they achieve, and how much money they earn, we lose sight of so many other elements that are important for human development, not just for children, but for all of us along our entire course of life. So the beauty of working at a place like Gallup is that we're doing studies across K-12, into higher education, into the workplace. We're studying the well-being of the entire planet. I kid you not, we actually run what we call our world poll, where we're statistically sampling 99% of the world's adult population every year, which means we have representative sampling frames set up in almost every single country around the world. And it all started 75-plus years ago with this guy, George Gallup, who, by the way, his original research obsession was not trying to predict the horse race in the presidential campaign. It was trying to quantify what he called a life well lived. And I love the way he describes it. We call it well-being today, just for purposes of giving it a one-word description, but it's essentially trying to quantify what it means to have a life well lived. And I'm going to come back to that in a little bit, because it's a bit of a hint towards careful what we measure, we become what we measure. And if all we're measuring is grades and test scores and earnings, those are very important outcomes, but they're horribly insufficient in and of themselves. So let me just take you into this a little bit. On one hand, We're actually using input measures today to judge the best colleges and universities. What do I mean? If you look at college ratings and rankings that are out there, a lot of them put enormous weight on the incoming test scores and grades and rank in class of students before they arrive. So these institutions get more points in the weighting scheme based on how high the SAT scores are, rank in class, and grades that the students get before they arrive at the university. We put that in a formula, and we say, here's the top universities in the country. This is just unbelievable this is true. No one has ever measured the learning growth of students from the time they matriculate to the time they graduate. On that, we have no idea what the best colleges and universities are because we've never tried to measure that. What do we put in there? Student-faculty ratios, size of the endowment, test scores before they arrived. Who knows? Maybe the Ivy League is just the best because all we're measuring is test scores, and they had the best test scores on the way in. They had the best grades and test scores on the way out. These are just fantastic students. It's an interesting question that we should be asking. And I'm not saying that it doesn't matter, because obviously those kinds of things sort in successful outcomes in life in a number of different ways. But there's a lot of interesting developments taking place that are going to start to shift our thinking on this big time. So on one hand, we're using inputs to measure what the best colleges and universities are. On the other hand, our output measures, our outcome measures, are incredibly limited in scope. So it's important that we track things like graduation rates and grades and to some degree test scores. But see, what we're not measuring is what happens after that. Because for the average American, the number one reason why they're interested in going to higher education, go to higher education, or are enrolled in higher education, number one reason, to get a good job. So here's the important thing to understand. If they graduate and get a diploma that doesn't end up in getting them a good job or a better job, that is a failure in that graduate's grade book. So although a diploma is an important flag that we want people to knock over, it's not the end-all, be-all goal that people have in going to higher education. Sure, yes, I want to get a diploma, I want to graduate, but what do I really want? I want to propel myself to a better career, a better life, right? And if you read the mission statements of colleges and universities, they talk about these things. I've actually read over 1,000 college mission statements. It's a hobby of mine. I know it's a sick hobby. But just do this for 5 or 10 of them, right? Go to the mission statement of your own institution. They post them everywhere. It's not hard to find these things. You know the most commonly used words in a college mission statement? This is a good little factoid. It's lifelong learning. So you go, okay, if that's the number one word professed in the mission statement of college universities, how are they measuring whether that's happening or not? This is a fair question because they've put it in their mission statement. Well, the honest answer is, really, I'm being a little harsh, no one has ever tried to measure that. And if they have, it's been a very minor example. Maybe there's a couple universities out there that did a survey of alumni and asked them how many books they read in the last month or, you know, something like that. Great, great step forward. But writ large, higher education is not even measuring some of the most important elements of its mission statement. Now, I'm not saying this is a measure of lifelong learning, but Gallup asked a question. This was the statement: I learn or do something interesting each day. And respondents were asked to strongly agree, 5-point scale, strongly disagree. So I'm not suggesting this is the end-all, be-all measure of lifelong learning, but it's a pretty interesting question, isn't it? I learn or do something interesting each day. You would think that college graduates are more likely to strongly agree to that question than people without a college degree. That's not true. There is no statistical difference between people with a bachelor's degree strongly agreeing to that question than somebody without a bachelor's degree. The only difference that starts to appear is if you have a postgraduate degree. And people with postgraduate degrees are slightly more likely to say they learn or do something interesting each day. So if we just start there, right, we need to think carefully about whether we're delivering on our mission. And obviously our mission statements go way beyond the things that we think of college. Here's a good stat. We know that if you get a bachelor's degree, on average, you make $850,000 more over your lifetime than someone who doesn't get one. Now, that is not an unimportant finding. In terms of economic success, a college degree is a pretty big difference maker in the grand scheme of things. But is that the only way that you in this room, I'm going to ask all of you the question, measure your life and your success and fulfillment and rewards? No. I mean, for some of you, it matters more than others. But here's the interesting thing. When Gallup studies something like well-being, well-being doesn't go up over $75,000 a year in annual income. Now, up to $75,000, you've got a little return on your well-being investment. After that, there's no difference in the likelihood that you rate or evaluate your life any better than someone who makes, say, $400,000 a year, et cetera, right? So we know that when it comes to well-being, we know that we measure things like workplace engagement. Not just do you have a job, but are you emotionally engaged in your work and your workplace? That has no relationship with your pay. It has no relationship with benefits. It has no relationship with whether there's a latte machine in the break room or whether there's a Segway scooter to tool around in the hallway with or a volleyball court outside, right? We think these are things that millennials want. Absolutely not. You know what the number one thing millennials want out of the workplace? Growth and development. That's it. There's your whole story. But you see how leaders get it wrong when they think the latte machines and the volleyball courts are the big drivers of what makes people happy at work? Forget about it. It's whether they feel that they're learning and growing. So I'm just sprinkling a lot of these things at you, and I'm going to keep hitting you with a number of these things. But see, it turns out that hope, one's ideas and energy for the future, as it is defined, is a stronger predictor of college success than SAT scores, ACT scores, and high school GPA. And so a lot of people start to go, what did you say? So usually in the back, somebody can't hear, and they go, did you say hope? And I say, yeah, I did. And so here's the thing. Hope, like measures of grit, engagement, well-being, these are all words that sound like real soft, fluffy things. First, the first hang-up we have is people don't think you can measure them. Patently untrue. You can reliably measure all of these things. The second thing people get hung up on is they go, okay, maybe you can measure those things, but do they really matter? The answer is absolutely. These are not soft measures. These are hard measures in terms of their ability to predict key performance on any level that we've ever tested it. And I'll explain a little bit more about that. So now, as I start to shift from our report card on grades and test scores and graduation rates in the United States and start to show you how we're doing on something like student engagement in school, things start to actually feel even more troubling than we probably think they are. Because Gallup, through our Gallup student poll, we just surveyed about 1 million 5th through 12th graders this past October. And here's what engagement in school looks like from elementary school to middle school to high school. It goes down every single year. Now, the way we measure engagement is a number of items. You get at their emotional engagement in their learning, right, in their school place, right, the kinds of connections they have with the human beings that are part of that process. What's interesting is that on a couple of the key items, some of the most important items, I would argue, through our research for human development, they score horribly. So here's one. I have a chance to do what I'm best at each day. 34% of fifth graders strongly agree to that. By 11th grade, it drops to 17%. Let me just run that by you again. Barely a third of fifth graders say they have a chance to do what they're best at each day in school. And by the time they get to 11th grade, it's a mere 17%. It drops in half from 5th to 11th grade. 12th grade looks like 11th grade. So the slide goes from 5th to 11 and basically stops there. Now, the other question that I would argue is the second most important question in the world. I have a mentor who encourages my development. 49% of 5th graders strongly agree to that. And that drops to 25% by 11th grade. I share both of these because through the lens of our work, by the way, these are the two most important questions for you today, right? It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter race, religion, culture, what country you're from. If you strongly agree you have a chance to do what you're best at each day, and you strongly agree you have someone who encourages your development, I can tell you with almost certainty that you are thriving in your well-being and engaged in your work. The odds that you're not are almost zero. By the way, if you can't strongly agree to both of those questions, think about this through the lens of self-efficacy, of how you might be able to get to that place. Maybe you're in a job where you've got a bum manager. That's actually one of the challenges for most people in terms of their workplace engagement. The number one driver of whether they're engaged in work is their manager. They either have a manager who encourages their development, helps them figure out what they're best at, creates a role or evolves their role so that they can do more of that each day, right? But the point here is that these are things that happen to us. They're also things that we can play a role in controlling. It's the same thing with students as well. Just think about college students, for example. They have choices to pick classes. Right now, they pick classes based on what kinds of classes they need to graduate. Here's some good advice. Pick the professor, not the class. If you can do it, think carefully about trying to find the best professors, the ones who have reputations for being world-class teachers, the ones who are, and by the way, these are no secrets. They're not on the websites of these colleges, but if you go on a campus and you start asking around, you will hear the names of every one of these people instantly. Your job is to try and take a class with every one of them. Now, I know you still have to take certain courses to meet your major requirements. I get it. But if you can pick the professor, not the course. These are simple examples that bear out from our research. Now, here's the problem. If you say, geez, Brandon, what a bum report card on student engagement. How can we improve student engagement? Well, of course, there's a long list of things we can talk about. But through the lens of Gallup research, there's just one simple answer. The biggest driver of student engagement is teacher and staff engagement, right? I mean, this is not rocket science. Through the lens of human behavior and organizations, this is simple. The number one driver of student engagement is an engaged teacher, staff person, administrator. So here's a provocative idea. Principals, I would argue, their job is not to drive student engagement in school. Their job is to drive teacher and staff engagement. You see how simple but powerful that shift in the thinking is of a principal's job? Because if a principal crushes it on driving engagement among staff and teachers, they are inevitably having a powerful impact on every single student in that building. They have a better chance of touching every teacher and staff member from that perspective than touching every student just based on sheer numbers. But here's the problem, and this is, I promise, the data. By the way, if you get overwhelmed by some of this data, here's a good technique for you. In our household, I've got a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, and we have this thing that we call Zen Frog It. So if our son Harrison is having a temper tantrum, we just go Zen Frog It, Harrison. He does some ohms, ohm. So if anybody gets a little worked up over some of these data points I'm sharing, just Zen Frog It. It'll start to feel better. Teachers of all professions in the United States, behind coal miners, truck drivers, and everybody else, are dead last on saying their opinions at work count. They're dead last on one of the most important elements of feeling empowered in their work. My opinions at work count. Look, I don't know how we got to this place, but shame on all of us that that's the case, that this prized profession of teaching, this thing that's a centerpiece of our healthy, thriving educonomy, is in a place where they feel like their opinions don't count. Here's a good one. We get worked up a lot over how we're doing in the U.S. in international standardized test comparisons, right? PISA, you've heard of PISA. And we don't look good on these measures right now. I mean, we're kind of like, you know, meddling scores in the 23 to 30 range of countries that are part of this study. And believe me, we need to do better on this. But here's just a simple thing to think about. Careful what you measure and careful what you're aiming at. Because this is interesting data, where there's 32 countries where there's overlapping measures between PISA standardized test score performance and entrepreneurial energy and activity in the country as measured by the global entrepreneurship measure. Both of these are data sets that are not Gallup data sets. But this is a really interesting piece of data to share, because what they found is that there is a negative correlation between standardized test scores and entrepreneurial energy in a country. Now, I'm not saying these things are mutually exclusive. You can definitely have high test scores and high entrepreneurial energy, and we ought to aim for both, but it's just really interesting to point out that where we think we're suffering greatly on standardized test score comparisons, the U.S. still looks pretty darn good on our entrepreneurial energy and activity relative to other countries. Now, you say, through the lens of South Carolina competing, this is a pretty important one. What does the entrepreneurial energy and activity look like for our students in school today? This is an interesting challenge to all of you. What would you do to identify kids who have, let's say, an interest or maybe particular aptitude in becoming entrepreneurs? What are our schools doing today to identify that talent and interest in our classrooms? By the way, we're real good at talent identification and a whole bunch of other things. We find every kid who crushes it on a standardized test score. We find every kid who's a great athlete, because, see, if you're a pro scout and you watch a guy drop back and throw a football in seventh grade, that scout can tell you right then whether they have the physical talent to play in the NFL. Isn't that, that's amazing, remarkable. See, if you have the eyes looking for the talent, we find it. We do this for musicians, right? We do this for artists, because those are things we can see. But what are we doing to identify kids with great entrepreneurial aspirations and interests? Right now, honestly, this is half true. It's half funny, but it's also half true. I think we'd do a better job identifying kids with entrepreneurial energy. What do we do with them? We're more likely to put them on ADHD meds than we are to put them in a program that might help them start a business. I'm just using this as one example. There are myriad talents in our schools, among our teachers and our students. And right now, we've got blinders on looking for a narrow set of these talents. And this goes back to the career and college-ready goals, right? We really mean college because, of course, you know, we don't hold it up as a great prize for somebody to go right into career or apprenticeship or whatever. I mean, by the way, career and technical training in the United States is going to have a massive resurgence. Why? Because we're starting to realize that a lot of middle-skilled jobs actually pay more money than some of the advanced degree fields that students are coming out of in postgraduate work. Welders in Louisiana, they can't find enough. Starting salary for welders is close to $100,000. You know what they're doing? They're importing welders from the Philippines because they don't have a pipeline in Louisiana that's filling the demands for the jobs there. There's a company there that won the contract to build all the ships for the U.S. Coast Guard. And the welders are coming from the Philippines, not from Louisiana. So shifting to what are we really aiming at here, it's important to measure grades and test scores and graduation rates, but what are we aiming at beyond that? And in simple terms, I think most of us would say something like, well, a great job and a great life, or a great career, and you know, not just about a job, but to have, you know, to be an engaged citizen and have a fulfilling life, right? If you ask yourself the question, what's the ultimate outcome of an education, you start to come up with much more profound answers and language than just simply saying graduation rates and grades. One of these things we've studied more than anybody in the world, and it's this idea I brought up earlier, well-being. Now, well-being, the way we've defined it, Gallup has found five crucial elements to the well-being of every human being. And they're basically described the way they are on this slide. Purpose, social, financial, physical, community. Let me just point out a couple. Purpose well-being, we used to call it career well-being, but you can have high purpose well-being and be unemployed or retired, for example. It's liking what you do each day and having a chance to do what you're best at each day. So you could hit the mark on those measures as a retiree. You could hit the mark on those measures as a stay-at-home parent. But the point is, those are really critical elements of your overall well-being. If you get purpose well-being right, the likelihood that you're thriving in the rest is extremely high. All five of these elements matter. That one matters more than any of them. Community well-being. Here's an example of where we're going wrong in the values we espouse to young people today. Community well-being. See how many of you can strongly agree to this question. In the last 12 months, I've received recognition for contributions made to my community. If you can strongly agree to that, you are among 7% of Americans who strongly agree. That's our gold standard question on community well-being. Here's the point. You don't get to that place by being loosely affiliated with 17 different extracurricular activities. You see where I'm going with this? I worry that we've told kids to pad resumes at the sake of missing the opportunity to be deeply, meaningfully engaged in any one of them. Now, I'm not saying don't encourage them to explore. Don't get me wrong. I think that's very important. But we also need to encourage them to think about sinking their teeth into something that they have a lasting involvement in over their 4 years of high school or their 4 or 5 or, I don't know, 7 years of college, depending on how long it takes. For the average American, it's now 6 years. This sounds like something nice to measure. But to my point earlier, this is not a soft measure. This matters a lot because, as it turns out, that if you have a citizen in the state of South Carolina who's thriving in all five elements of well-being, they have 1/3 the healthcare cost burden to the state or their employer than an employee or a citizen who's not thriving in any. And you don't have to get everybody thriving in all five, which is a relatively high bar. For every element, you can take somebody from 0 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3 elements of well-being. The healthcare cost burden just keeps going down. Why is this important? Well, our national healthcare tab right now is about $2.7 trillion, going on $2.9 trillion. To put it in perspective, that's almost $1 trillion more than the entire Russian GDP. Think about that. Our healthcare tab in the U.S. is bigger than the entire GDP of Russia. So some people could make a case that our country is on our way to bankruptcy because of our healthcare tab. Do you think well-being is a nice to have or a need to have? And like well-being, we measure this other thing called workplace engagement, the degree to which you're engaged in your work, whatever that work is. And there's questions that we found are linked to things like productivity, absenteeism, turnover. Here's the important point. Like well-being, engagement is not a nice to have, it's a need to have. In studies that we've done, if you have engaged employees, quite simply, they're more productive, they're less likely to be absent, they're less likely to steal from your organization, they stay there longer. If this is measured in for-profit companies, they produce more revenue and profit. All those things sound pretty important, don't they? Guess what the number one driver is of those classic economic outcomes? They're behavioral economic measures of the people who work there. So let me just shift now to the next question. Is our graduates career and life ready? Because this is essentially the goal of our entire education system, that in some form or another we want to hit the mark on either one of these things or both of these. And look, this is not, it's interesting. We're having this whole conversation about the value of a liberal arts degree in our country right now. It's unbelievable. When you go and listen to panels at conferences about this, it's like, this is literally a discussion. It's either liberal arts or careerism. As if those two things have nothing to do with one another. And you go, really? Have we dumbed down this conversation so much that it's just liberal arts or careerism? It's not an either or, it's an and both conversation that we need to be having. There are elements of the liberal arts education that are powerfully connected to successful career outcomes. But it's almost like in the liberal arts, people don't want to talk about the career value of the liberal arts as if that's kind of beneath the liberal arts. I mean, we're having this bizarre talk. And then, by the way, career and technical training, a lot of the evolution in that side of the equation, right, if you want to try and draw a line between these things, has been about building things like critical thinking, skilled communication, collaboration, writing into those programs. Those things sound very liberal artish, don't they? I mean, here's the point. This is an and both conversation. We need to stop the stupid around making it an either or conversation. So are graduates career and life ready? Let me just start with high school students first. And the first obvious thing we've discovered is that on anything that relates to a real work experience, either a real one or a simulated one, students are just woefully inadequate. Less than 5% of high school students are currently interning with a local organization in any form. And only 17% say they've worked an hour more in a paid job in the last week. So on these measures, very few students are getting any real crack at real work experience. What's interesting, though, is when we do a study of young Americans, this was a representative study of 18 to 35-year-olds looking at their experiences in school and the relationship with those experiences to their career success as young adults. We had a long list of things we studied in this particular project, all kinds of 21st century skill examples, whether you use technology to complete an assignment, whether you worked in a team, all kinds of things. But two bubbled up as having a relationship with work success as young adults. And they were whether these people strongly agreed to these two questions. Whether they worked on a project that took more than a few classes to complete, a long-term project, and whether they had the opportunity to apply what they were learning to solving a real-world problem. Now, does that sound like an overwhelming set of things to make happen in school? Not at all. But you look at the percentages who hit the mark on these things, and you get pretty down pretty quickly. What works in school looks like real work. And there's all kinds of ways to make this happen, from the obvious of internships and apprenticeship opportunities to the less obvious of project-based learning opportunities that are crafted around solving real problems. We can do this in every single class we teach. I've seen it in Intro to Spanish just as much as I've seen it in STEM courses where you can think of obvious examples of projects. Now let me shift to higher education. And this is an interesting one on the perceptions of how well we're doing on work readiness for college students and graduates. So Gallup, I have to admit, this was not strategic. We got lucky on this one because we asked a similar question in three different studies we did over the last 2 years. One was a survey of chief academic officers, provosts of colleges and universities. And as you'll see, 98% are confident that they're doing a good job preparing students for the workplace. In a poll of the general population of Americans, only 11% strongly agree that college graduates are well prepared for success in the workplace. So obviously, there's a lot going on here. I mean, the difference between 98 and 11%, there's some perception issues, there's communication issues, and there's probably some real fundamental skills gap issues. All of that is in the middle of that thing. That's a gulf so big I can't even explain it in statistical terms. But you go, well, Brandon, what does the general population know about the work readiness of college grads, right? Like, you know, that's just, well, how about C-level business executives? This was the third survey we did, a representative sample of C-level business executives, and it turns out their report card's even a little worse. 11% strongly agree that college graduates have the skills they're looking for in the jobs that they have open. So obviously, this is an example of we have a lot of work to do, and I think in a simple way, it starts with getting people in the same room together, just as is happening here this morning. Employers have to play a major role in this equation. It's no longer acceptable for employers to point the fingers at either higher education or K-12 and say, you're not giving me what I need. Unless and until they're clear about what they need and they start to step up and build real, lasting relationships with schools and colleges and universities to make sure that those things are happening. Employers can help teachers come up with project-based learning examples for the classroom based on real problems they're trying to solve on the assembly line at the BMW plant. They can offer internships and in much bigger numbers. And by the way, this isn't just the Fortune 500 companies because we think of them in obvious terms. What about all the small and medium-sized employers that are just down the street from any number of these campuses? We forget about them entirely. Students don't think about them because they don't know their name. They might not even know they exist. But where there's wide open opportunity here is connectivity between colleges, universities, school districts, and all the small and medium employers out there. The large ones are obvious, and so they get targeted, they reach out, they do a number of things. But if you calculated pound for pound the number of internships that Fortune 500s are offering based on their employee size compared to small and medium-sized employers and the value that those internships have to them, I'll give you my example. I was a 7-employee firm in Boston as a startup. And someone from Northeastern's co-op office called me and said they wanted to have a meeting to talk to me about their co-op program. I wasn't looking for them. I didn't go on their website. But someone made a call and scheduled a 30-minute meeting with me. They came out, explained the co-op program. These students get 6 months to work in your company. You pay them $14 an hour. And I was intrigued on two levels, because if they didn't work out, you send them back. They're getting paid, so I knew they were going to try and do a good job. And I got them for 6 months, which means that it wasn't the proverbial 6-week summer thing where you're like, geez, I don't know what I can have you do for 6 weeks. I'm going to have you copy some papers for me and get some coffee for us, right? I gave them real jobs because I was a 7-employee firm. The first co-op student we hired, Kim Durkin, we made our director of marketing because I didn't have a director of marketing. She literally got a real job. She did the real job. We hired her. We ended up having an 11-year relationship with Northeastern. Dozens of co-op students worked with us over that time, and they were amazing employees, not just interns. They helped move the needle on the performance of our company in very important ways. Here's the point. A 30-minute meeting from somebody at Northeastern led to an 11-year relationship and dozens of co-op opportunities in a tiny employer in the city of Boston. Guys, I don't think that this is impossible work to do, right? I don't think that this is impossibly costly work to do. This is not easy, but it's a change in what we value and how we spend our time. We don't need to issue billion-dollar bonds to increase the connectivity between employers and schools. We just need to issue some elbow grease. So now let me tell you about the things that we found about college that relate to success in the long run. The next three things I'm going to share with you, what we called being emotionally supported, if you strongly agree to any one of those, it doubles the odds that you end up engaged in your work over your lifetime and doubles the odds that you're thriving in your well-being. These are kind of career and life trajectory game changers in the grand scheme of things. Here's what they are. Ask yourselves these questions. These are 5-point scales, 5 strongly agree. I'm only interested in if you can strongly agree. If you can't, it's a no. So how many of you strongly agree that you had at least one professor who made you excited about learning? Just raise your hands. I'm curious. How's the room doing on that one? Pretty good. Almost everybody. Nationally, 64% of all college graduates strongly agree to that. Sounds like a pretty good percentage until you realize that about 4 in 10 don't. And it was only worded as at least one professor over their 4 or 5 or 6 years. Now, I ask the next question. This is a more broad one, right? Not a professor, but the professors at my alma mater cared about me as a person. How many strongly agree? Oh, see, the numbers are dwindling. About a third of the room, which is kind of consistent here, 27% of college graduates in the U.S. strongly agree to that one. Here, by the way, is the most important one. How many of you strongly agree that you had a mentor who encouraged your goals and dreams? Oh, wow. Please note that this is a special group. You're a very special group. That's unbelievable. I'd say, what, the official Gallup poll results, about half of you raised your hand? You guys think? Was that about right, about half? That's more than double the national average, because it turns out only 2 out of 10 college graduates strongly agree to that question. And as odds ratios go, this one has the strongest relationship with engagement and well-being later in life. Here's the problem. Only 14% of all college graduates in the U.S. hit the mark on all three of these precious emotional support elements of college. Now, we also found 3 deep learning or experiential elements that also double your odds of being engaged in work later. They only have a little relationship with well-being. Okay, so these 3 are just as important for work engagement, but they only have a little relationship with well-being. Here's what they are. How many of you strongly agree that you had a long-term project that took a semester or more to complete? This is such an interesting one. Because less than a third of all college graduates hit the mark on this one. And you go, how is that possible that over 4 or 5 or 6 years, you didn't have one class that required a semester-long project or engagement? This one, to me, is inexcusable. But see, here's the trade-off that everybody's making rationally around this. The typical student and their parent, in looking at course selection, will take a course that's easier so they can get a higher grade than to take a course that's harder that might involve a long-term project. Not because they're lazy. There might be a few that's the reason. But I think they're making a rational choice because they've been told that a higher GPA is more important than a long-term project experience. And everybody goes, yep, that's the right call. Do that, Johnny. Take the easier course because you need that 4.0 or so-and-so is never going to hire you. Guess what? 80% of the world's experts in education, we did a survey of experts from 149 countries, 80% would rather hire a B student with an internship than an A student without one. And I'll go into a little bit of data, too, on these long-term project engagement because it's a part of one. But you go, less than a third of college graduates worked on a semester-long project. The next one, this is important. This is what we call a sorting question because we also asked a question whether you had a paid job during college, yes or no. If you say yes, that has no relationship with your workplace engagement later in life. Now, I'm not saying that's bad. You made a paycheck, right, that helped pay for some of the expenses of college, so not a loss on that. But as it relates to workplace engagement, just having a paid job doesn't have a relationship. But if you said you had a job or an internship, here's the really important words, where you applied what you were learning in the classroom, that doubles your odds of being engaged in work later in life. But you see the important difference? One is a job. The other one is a work experience connected to your learning. If those two things don't go together, we miss a huge opportunity. And so let me just finish on this point, and we'll open up for questions with any of the time we have left. This is a little more complicated chart. So the lighter color bars are the percentage of graduates who strongly agree to a question. Here's the question. I was well prepared for life outside of college. I mean, who better to judge that than the graduate themselves, right? What a simple question to ask people. I was well prepared for life outside of college. So that's the percent who strongly agree. And as you can see, it goes from 5% on the left to 85% on the right. Now, here's what the other bars are. It's the percent of college graduates who hit the mark on 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6 of those 6 key elements that I just shared. Here's the first eye-popping result, that 25% of all college graduates are a 0 on that precious 6-question scale. If this was an auto assembly plant, we would recall a quarter of all of our graduates. Because the likelihood that those graduates say they were well prepared for life outside of college, 5% of them say they were well prepared. Keep in mind that 100% of the people in this data set met the academic requirements to receive a diploma from their institution. And yet, if you were on the left side of the scale that Gallup is measuring, only 5% of those graduates say they're well prepared for life. If you were on the right scale, this is a high bar, if you say strongly agree to all 6, how many say strongly agree to all 6? You are a 2.7%er. Congratulations. That's a pretty high bar to get. Now, I don't think that the expectation is that every graduate hits the mark on all 6 of these. That's kind of an unfair expectation. But don't you think it's fair to think that graduates hit the mark on at least 2 or 3 or 4 of these? Does that sound like a more fair way to think about this? The reality is that almost half of all college graduates are a 0 or 1 on this scale. But see, if you hit all 6, 85% of you strongly agree you're well prepared for life outside of college. So let me end there. I really appreciate the chance to be here with you today, and I hope these data and some of these ideas give you some real energy to think differently about what you're doing, what we're doing, and how we can get better. So thank you so much.
Brandon Busteed, keynote speaker at the 2016 Transform SC Spring Conference held in March in Columbia. Thanks for joining us for today's podcast. Interesting, informative comments by Dr. Busteed given at that conference, and that's the type of program that we like to have each week here on Speaking of Schools. Of course, it is presented by South Carolina's Department of Education and is available on a weekly basis here at this website. My name is Doug Keel. I'm the host and producer for the podcast, and I invite you to join us again next week when we'll be speaking of schools.